David Garland. Welcome to Evening Music, and welcome, too, to Brian Lehrer, who is joining me right now.
Hello, David.
Brian, it's nice to have you here in the evening. I know you work long and hard on the Brian Lehrer Show, and this week working even longer, but I hope it doesn't feel hard for you to come and share some music.
You know, on a Saturday night, I might be home listening to music anyway, so to come in here and share some with you and share some with the listeners is a double pleasure, even though I have to say it feels just a little bit strange to be sitting here in the guest seat while you're working the controls and someone else is the host.
Well, the tables have been turned on you. And WNYC is having its Must Have Festival, time during which we have invited folks from within the station and from outside. For example, composer John Zorn joins me at 9 o'clock tonight.
One of my musical heroes, by the way.
Really?
And someone who, without even realizing he was going to be following me, I had considered including in my Must Have set, but didn't. But I'm so proud to be followed by John Zorn.
So folks have been joining us to share the music that they feel they must have in their lives, music that's really important to them, that's enriched them, that's surprised them, that's made them the person they are. And that's what Brian Lehrer has brought with him tonight. And it'll include works by Bartok and Messiaen and Steve Reich a little later, but you wanted to start with Miles Davis.
That's right. And first, and I won't talk too much before we get into the first track, Miles as a sideman before he ever got to be a leader. This goes back to 1947 when he was with Charlie Parker's band, Parker the great alto saxophone player. And all I want to say about this is that this is going to sound very tame and familiar to your ears probably right now, but this was so strange and new and outside in 1947 that Louis Armstrong described Charlie Parker derisively as playing Chinese music for the way it sounded to him. This is the classic Moose the Mooch. Here's Miles on the muted trumpet solo. Right? So, you know, classic jazz, but compared to what came before it, very outside and weird and very hot. Charlie Parker was considered red hot. And then came the Miles career as a leader. And David, what I chose really for my must-have is the entire Miles Davis discography.
Oh, really?
Yes. We're only going to play, we're going to sample short excerpts like that from five different Miles things. But the overarching umbrella here is that I would lead my must-have collection with the entire Miles Davis discography, American classical music, you know, every bit as much as Copland or Gershwin or name whoever you want as an icon of American classical music. And why? Well, I don't claim that Miles is the best composer ever. I don't claim that he's the greatest trumpeter ever. I admire Miles so much because of his relationship to change. Miles first recorded as a leader in the late 1940s on a CD that we're about to hear. Of course, they weren't CDs then. As part of a young movement that was inventing cool jazz. And, you know, many composers of any type of music settle down into the style that they're known for once they've made their one major innovation.
Right.
But not Miles. He went on to help invent 50s bop, 60s avant-garde, and 70s jazz rock. And really, he innovated four times in four decades, always as a creative leader, not a commercial copycat just trying to stay current. And, you know, growing up through the tail end of this and then realizing the history of Miles, it just was so formative for me as a listener and an appreciator of music and, you know, almost gave me part of my approach to life.
Really?
In that respect, and even left me a little bit allergic to nostalgia because the idea of wallowing in my own past became kind of a negative.
Do you feel you've been able to accomplish this in your life? Was there an earlier phase of Brian Lehrer that's changed and become something new?
Sure, always. Mm-hmm. I hope so. You know, I started life in radio doing music programming. We'll leave that there.
And you've devolved into a talk show host.
Exactly right. But let's play some of Miles Davis, and we'll go through a little of the progression just for fun. That was the Red Hot for the time. Moose the Mooch, Charlie Parker. And then Miles' first album was the classic The Birth of the Cool, which helped put cool jazz on the map. And here he dials back a little bit from the, you know, to do something more arranged, more composed, less improvised and elegant.
Thank you.
Now flash forward 10 years to 1959 and hear Miles burn on the trumpet right at the beginning of this. Come out of this excerpt now, and that's great fun. After the Miles trumpet solo, he had this great sextet where he had the alto saxophonist Cannonball Adderley and the legendary tenor saxophonist John Coltrane together in his band before Coltrane became a leader and Cannonball Adderley became a leader. And they were, if you were paying attention there, you heard them trading riffs in such a fun way. I love that track. That track is just so much fun. And how different from The Birth of the Cool, right? And right. And a different kind of hard bopping than Charlie Parker did, taking it up to already a more contemporary sound. Mm. And the very beginning of the cerebral adventure, which I think you could hear a little bit in Miles' solo and a little bit in the theme composition, the cerebral adventure that he was to embark upon in the 60s.
Hmm.
And that's where we're going to go next. We're going to flash forward again to an excerpt of a track from 1966, this time, from the CD Miles Smiles, another one of my favorites in the discography. And we're going to play some of the first track from this, Orbits. And by now, Miles is finished with regular jazz sounds. And I talked about how he just kept taking in the tempo of the times around him and musically leading in that context. Miles and his band here are striving towards something more cerebral and experimental. And it sounds like jazz, but it's music for exploring your inner worlds, not for exploring bars or dance halls, like jazz was probably mostly thought of before that. And, you know, this is 1966, so it's consistent with the questioning of all assumptions about all forms and structures that was going on in society then. So let's just hear a little bit of Orbits from Miles Smiles, 1966, and you'll hear the change from the last Straight Ahead thing.
Brian Lehrer is making the choices here on WNYC's Must Have Festival. Listening to some recordings by Miles Davis, chosen for us by Brian Lehrer, who joins me for WNYC's Must Have Festival. Brian explained a few minutes ago that ideally his must have list would have everything that Miles Davis recorded as part of it. And in lieu of that, which would take a few days, we're just...
5 2.5-minute samples. It's for radio, you know. Yeah. It's like, they say if there was broadcast news in ancient Israel, that they would have told the story this way. God gave Moses the Ten Commandments today. The most important two were... So we're doing the broadcast version of the entire Miles Davis discography. And I chose the discography in its fullness because of Miles Davis' relationship to change. More than, to my ear, most musicians of any genre, he changed. And if he didn't change, he got restless and he got unhappy and frustrated.
Yeah, and his changes really had him turning his back on what went before. It evolved out of what went before, but he never went back and redid something the way seems more common for people to do now.
He would refuse to do it. He would refuse to do it live in his concerts, too. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, he would regularly infuriate critics who had become fans of one thing or another because he was changing faster than they were.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were constantly accusing Miles of being fashionable rather than musical. And history has proven, I think, that, you know, 4 or 5 times he changed into something that was enduringly musical.
Mm. It was interesting. You were pointing out about how the ensemble that Miles Davis led, which we were just listening to with Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, and Tony Williams, how they were really breaking with the traditional assumptions about composition and improvisation in the world of jazz. But they were still the traditional jazz ensemble,
right,
with the two horns, the bass, drums, and piano. But then he broke with that as well.
And then he broke with that as well. And just as in the mid-60s, Bob Dylan infuriated the pure folkies by plugging in, Miles Davis in the late 60s infuriated the pure jazz people by plugging in. And I have to tell you a story about this, because how I first became exposed to this now has a WNYC connection.
Okay.
In 1970, Jonathan Schwartz was the first one to get me into Miles.
Hmm.
When I was a teenager, lying on Jones Beach, listening to his show on WNEW-FM. And he segued from some rock and roll song, I wish I could remember what, to something from Bitches Brew, Miles' breakout into, you know, cranked up jazz rock fusion CD that we're going to sample from. And I was blown away by the rock textures meeting jazz instrumental chops.
Hmm.
And so there's the WNYC connection with Jonathan Schwartz, now on WNYC. And so Spanish Key, the track that we'll hear a little bit of, is a great example of that. And check out, just for fun, because, you know, first you'll hear the electric guitar of John McLaughlin and the electric piano of Joe Zawinul, or I think Chick Corea on this track, actually. But check out, for the fun of it, Benny Maupin's bass clarinet exploring around through the rock forest.
Music chosen by Brian Lehrer here on WNYC. Is just really starting to bubble, but we have to take it off the burner.
Otherwise, we won't get to the rest of the music that we want to play today. Just a sample that goes on for 17 minutes, and I actually don't think you want to hear 17 minutes of it.
I do.
But if you do, know, they still sell Bitches Brew, so.
There's even some swanky box set with outtakes from the sessions and all that.
Oh, really?
I believe.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so.
So
Miles Davis, yeah, amazing.
And that ends, you know, you were talking about how he, we were talking off the air, and David was saying how Miles would find these most unusual notes to hang on. And really, if you listen, you could sort of get it from the tracks that we played. And even as he continued and continued to change again into different kinds of rock and R&B and stuff like that, and actually to my ear, finally less successfully in the 80s. But he and his chops gradually went downhill as he got older. That is, his ability to play really fast and hard and with super clean tone, as he was known for. He developed the ability to go from the kind of jazz player who played a lot of notes pretty well to the jazz player who could find that one perfect note.
Yeah.
I think if he could, you know.
And it sounds like an ideal. You would want to do that,
exactly.
But he did it.
He did it. Over and over again. So that ends the mild discography portion of the hour.
Brian Lehrer is joining me. You know him from The Brian Lehrer Show, heard Monday through Friday during the daytime here on WNYC from 10 to 12. And now he's joining me for WNYC's Must Have Festival, and we have more from him in just a moment.
WNYC salutes the arts. Join us in supporting local cultural organizations, including Thalia Spanish Theater, offering dance musicals, concerts, and bilingual theater in Western Queens, Musical Chairs Chamber Ensemble, where emerging artists perform classic and contemporary works on Staten Island, and The Queens Company, presenting classic plays with all-female, ethnically diverse casts. For more information about arts in New York, click on the events page at WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by Zagat Survey, publisher of restaurant and lifestyle guides to 90 cities worldwide, including dining, nightlife, shopping, and travel. These and the new 2006 New York City Restaurants Guide are in bookstores and Zagat.com. And WNYC is a media sponsor of the African Diaspora Film Festival. Tomorrow, Lars von Trier's Manderley, starring Danny Glover and Willem Dafoe. An IFC release. Details at nyadff.org. So, Brian Lehrer, you have more from us, and we're leaving Miles Davis and the world of jazz to the world of Olivier Messiaen.
Indeed. And for some reason, I've always been drawn to the power and beauty of two works of 20th century classical music that were written by Europeans facing their own mortality during the 1940s, the World War II years. Messiaen wrote Quartet for the End of Time in a German prison camp in 1940 for the only players who were in the camp with him, a clarinetist, a violinist, and a cellist. And then we're going to go on to some Bartok, which is another one of my just all-time favorites. But they're connected in a way. But this movement from the Messiaen is very short, less under 2 minutes, intermed, and it combines his anguish and his energy. Thank you. So he could be that whimsical in a German prison camp.
Yeah.
That version, Gil Shaham on violin, Paul Meyer clarinet, John Wong violoncello, and Myung-Won Chung on piano. That version is known for intensifying everything about this piece. The fast movements are faster, the slow movements are slower, and that movement had some kick to it.
And that having just that movement really gives us only a glimpse of that piece, doesn't it? I mean, you and I know the piece as a whole and know that it has this incredible intensity and at other times incredible tranquility to
it. That's right. That's right. Yes. So enough said there, because I see I think we're a little bit behind here because
of
all the blah, blah, blah with all the music that we want to get in. You know, usually I get paid to blah, blah, blah.
Right, so you have to change gears here.
That's right. But let's set up the next piece. Bartok. With Miles, you know, I would probably, if I had to go to the classical repertoire, it's heretic to say it, but I wouldn't start with Mozart or Beethoven. I personally would start with Bartok. And there's something about him, his writing and his... I guess really his writing, he was a composer, that just hits me right where I live, emotionally and intellectually and musically. He bridges the romantic and the modern and the lush and the cerebral, and I love his ensemble writing. And so I chose part of his concerto for orchestra, which is just what it sounds like. Usually you think of a concerto as being for one instrument with accompaniment. And his concerto for orchestra is his genius work for orchestra. I think the title is apt because the orchestra's ensemble playing is the featured soloist. And I was really torn between the first movement and the last movement. The last movement is a really fun romp, but we're going to romp on another composer after this. So we'll play the first movement instead, which begins pensively and becomes this lush inner journey that has the different sections of the orchestra keeping each other on their toes.
Pierre Boulez directs the New York Philharmonic. And this music by Bartok, chosen by Brian Lehrer. We're listening to Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, just an excerpt of this, as has been the case with many other pieces that we've been playing tonight during Brian Lehrer's segment of our must-have festival.
I overprogrammed.
Well, this gives people a taste of the music, and then
right.
We all hope they'll pursue it and add it to their collection, or keep listening to WNYC when we usually play these things from start to finish.
I love the section that just preceded that orchestral spiraling up that was taking place, where the flute section and the cello section are keeping each other engaged. And there is a connection between the Bartok and the Messiaen, which is why I put them together, which is that Bartok, too, thought he was facing death. In fact, he was, by natural causes, pretty soon thereafter. Messiaen survived his time in the German prison camp, and Bartok was the New York Philharmonic Pierre Boulez version from the 70s, Boulez having studied with Messiaen. Enough about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Brian Lehrer sharing his choices for WNYC's Must Have Festival here on 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC is supported by the New York Revels, presenting the Christmas Revels with traditional music, dance, stories, and songs inspired by Elizabethan England, December 9th through the 11th at Symphony Space. Tickets at 212-864-5400 or symphonyspace.org. And WNYC is supported by cultural arts partner Poets House, a poetry library and literary center at 72 Spring Street, now celebrating its 20th anniversary season. Poets House is free and open to the public. Details at poetshouse.org.
WNYC salutes the arts. Join us in supporting local cultural organizations, including Thalia Spanish Theater, offering dance musicals, concerts, and bilingual theater in Western Queens, Musical Chairs Chamber Ensemble, where emerging artists perform classic and contemporary works on Staten Island, and The Queens Company, presenting classic plays with all-female, ethnically diverse casts. For more information about arts in New York, click on the events page at WNYC.org.
Brian Lehrer, you do or did play the flute, isn't that correct?
Yeah, I grew up playing the flute. I was, the height of my musical career was when I was 13, and I was the third-ranked flute player in the Queens public school system.
All right, congratulations.
It's been all downhill ever since. However, the next piece that I chose is just one of my personal flute favorites. This is a 1985 recording of flutist Ransom Wilson playing Steve Reich's Vermont Counterpoint. And so this is kind of 11 flutes on ecstasy as Ransom Wilson takes me to a state of bliss with Reich's playful, ever-changing romp. The top of 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 the top of
Thank you.
Vermont Counterpoint by Steve Reich. And all flute parts were played by Ransom Wilson, and there were 11 flute parts. At first, when you introduced it, Brian Lehrer, I thought you said they were unleavened flutes, but I realized that you meant 11.
And
That's what you said.
For people who don't know that piece, that may be the first time you ever heard 11 flutes. It's really ranging from piccolo down to bass flute, all played by Ransom Wilson. And I've never seen that done live, but I'm told that when they do that live, it's supposed to be done with 9 pre-recorded flute tracks and 2 live soloists. It must be so much fun.
Why not 11 live soloists, I wonder?
Money.
Oh, okay.
I guess.
See, you're so much more aware of how things really work, Brian Lehrer. Host of the Brian Lehrer Show here Monday through Friday.
To my detriment. Not being host of the show, being aware of reality.
Yeah, I get to just kind of waft in here and play some lovely music for people, and you have to face reality. I have an easier job.
Which brings us to our last piece. And because you out there know me as that news talk guy, we'll finish up with something new that references current events and, who knows, could someday become a 21st century American music tragicomedy classic, I will call it. This is my current must-have CD, my must-have CD of the moment. And this is Phil Klein, something that he calls 3 Rumsfeld songs, and we will play 2 of them. They are lyric songs using the words of that unintentional poet of Iraq war planning, Donald Rumsfeld, sort of the Yogi Berra of the Department of Defense, if you know what I mean.
I wish he was that harmless.
And I'm going to read you the text of these 2 actually very short songs, totaling under 4 minutes. And then you'll be probably more prepared after hearing the Rumsfeldian language spoken to hear the singing of them. This is something that he said about a year before the war started when he was asked about what they know. And he said, "As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know."
It must have been said off the cuff, but it sounds like someone worked for hours.
Right, and it was
making that convoluted language.
Off the cuff, it sounded like. and then the second one, you may remember this, just after Baghdad fell to coalition forces. This is April 11th, 2003. Remember when the chaos was just starting to break out? There was looting of the museums, which was the first sign that all was not going to be orderly and peaceful after, we took over from Saddam Hussein. And there were all these pictures of the looting that were being played on television. And Rumsfeld went on and he said, "It's the same picture of some person walking out of some building with a vase. And you see it 20 times and you think, my goodness, were there that many vases? Is it possible that there were that many vases in the whole country?" So we'll hear those 2. And with this, I guess I say goodbye, David.
Brian Lehrer, thank you so much for sharing your choices on WNYC's Must Have Festival. It's great to have you in.
Too much fun.
So we'll have these Rumsfeld songs, and then I'll be joined by composer John Zorn with his Must Haves here on WNYC. Thanks, Brian.
Walking out.